You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
In this hour, we look at South Africa's welfare state. Now, I'm sure a lot of you will have a lot to say about this one, and I want you to be part of this conversation. Call in, give your views, give your experiences, your ideas for what we need to do. We're in a bit of a, I suppose, there's a conundrum that we struggle with in South Africa. On the one hand, we have millions of people who need the state in order to make sure that they do not live under conditions of extreme poverty in particular. And that means that unless you are completely inhumane, you have to be on board with the idea of a welfare state. But of course, since 1994 all the way until 2018, we've gone from around 4 million or so people, depending on the state for various kinds of grants, to a situation where I think the latest figures were around 17.5 million almost South Africans who are dependent. That can't be a good thing. Not only because it raises questions of the sustainability of the welfare state in the face of low levels of economic growth, low levels of unemployment, but also beyond that, just from a dignity point of view. I'm not sure whether work necessarily makes you dignified. I think it depends which work you have. But no doubt, if you are the author of your own life, that is far more deeply rewarding and a far more flourishing life than one where you get handouts from the state. So the big question we're asking this hour is it time to rethink the South African welfare state? And what might that mean in terms of the nuts and bolts for how welfare should be rethought? And joining me now is the Chief Operating Officer at Soul City Institute and also, of course, former Director General of Social Development, Zane Dango. Zane, it's wonderful having you on my show. Thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning, Yusebis. It's good to be here.
Let's start at a high level. And I say high level, but it really, all of this is inherently practical, particularly for the poorest of the poor. We used to, and fortunately, I think we've moved away, have a philosophical and policy debate about the welfare state in South Africa, whether we even need it. I would imagine, at least between you and me, maybe not all of our listeners, we can take for granted that there is a moral imperative to have a welfare state.
Yes, there is. And I think what has happened over a couple of years, and for whatever reasons, the nature of the state, whether it's a welfare state or the way some people conceive of a developmental state, has been discussed and contested. But if we take the high-level view of how our own post-apartheid state was constructed, if you look at our Bill of Rights, it's one of the few countries in the world that actually had a vision that for the next 100 years, we're going to have high levels of poverty, we're going to have high levels of inequality. And in fact, our Bill of Rights makes provision for social protection. It makes provision for a state that will take care of those who are unable to take care of themselves. And it's been modeled essentially on what is the International Bill of Rights, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which globally has been recognized. If you don't have this package of issues within what a state or a society provides, you are going to have a society where the have-nots, those who cannot look after themselves, are going to be left on the periphery. And that the kind of societies where you have a trickle-down economy just doesn't work. So for those who argue that social protection is discretionary, I say, read Section 27 of the Constitution. It's not discretionary.
That is such a good point, you know. I mean, I don't know, because I've seen poverty, I have it in my family, the communities where I come from, I take for granted that even if it's not a moral imperative, it's very imprudent not to have a welfare state when you have gross levels of inequity and incredible levels of poverty. But I love the way how you are connecting it even to the very normative vision of our Constitution, because we often talk very intellectually about things like socioeconomic rights being enshrined in the Constitution. But if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying quite apart from the fact that it's the decent thing to do, it is also the constitutional thing to do.
Yes, it is. And I lecture at Wits and we had the discussion on the same issue, ironically, in the last week, with senior public servants, and people are talking about the issue of dependency. So we problematize the issue of dependency. And firstly, just from a monetary perspective, we don't have the dole. We basically, our social protection levels are at levels which we can categorize as survival levels. So you cannot create dependency on that low. The quantum is too low to create dependency in the first instance. The second issue that we found, and this is over a number of years, and research is not just done by the South African government, but done by UNICEF, the World Bank, I found that, contrary to what people believe, that households will actually access some form of social income, whether it's through the old age pension or the child support grant or a combination of the two. And even when you have adults who are unemployed and do not directly receive that grant, they are more likely to go out and look for work. The basic reason is the experience of getting a regular income in the house. Now, in a society where there is not that wide experience of getting a regular income in the house, just that experience has made people want to replicate it, want to actually increase that quantum for their own households, and it's actually have the incentive for people to go out and look for work.
I want to come back to that because it opens up a whole range of myths, some of which are intuitively coherent but empirically false about the experience of the grant, abuse, why people might even deliberately try and fall pregnant, which is one of the worst ones. We're going to come back to that. You talk about how low the quantum is, too low to be able to talk about dependency. Now, that fascinates me because a sentence like the following one often rolls off the tongues of middle-class black and white South Africans and taxpayers like myself. We will say the welfare state in South Africa is massive. Is it massive? Is there a way one can even evaluate a claim like that by international norms, for example? Do we have, if I asked you just casually at a braai, Zane, do we have a massive welfare state? How would you respond to that?
I would say that we have a nascent welfare state. That we've got a state that is compelled to provide for those who cannot provide them for themselves. And look at who do we provide for. So we provide for children because they're not in the economic space. We provide for the disabled because they're not in the economic space, and we provide for the elderly because they're actually beyond the age where they are active in the economy.
Sure.
And we provide for the elderly who, after 20, 30 years of work, retire into poverty because we don't actually have a retirement regime that encourages or provides for the fact that, you know, like in the established welfare states of Europe, that we all contribute to a single fund and nobody retires into poverty. We have a nascent welfare state. So what is discretionary is the amount.
Okay.
The duty to provide is not discretionary. And I think this is the thing. When political parties begin to use social assistance as a tool to look at votes, I always remind them that all of you, whether it's the IFP, whether it's the DA, whether it's the ANC or the EFF, unless you get 75%, not 2/3, to change the constitution, you are compelled to provide to those who cannot provide for themselves. What is discretionary is the quantum. And I think that is where we may be arguing that it's not enough.
Okay. And so when people fixate on that 17.5 million, because I sometimes hear right-wing economists, certain center-right think tanks, they will say things like, well, just look at the number of people who are in the labor market that are taxpayers that can be taxed, and then put next to that the number of people that are actually getting some form of grant or some form of social support from the state, upwards of 17 million. And then they will say, find me another country where the numbers are that lopsided.
We can look at Sweden. We can look at Denmark. We can look at any of the Nordic states. And obviously, you pay for this through taxation. And the more people that you have in this space that can pay tax, then the state becomes able to actually deal with the quantum issue better. Because at the moment, because of our tax regime, you know, the small tax base, it's the quantum issue. And when you have compelling interest, you know, do you fund social protection? Do you fund infrastructure? And that is where government departments need to make compelling bids to national treasury. And it's in that compelling bid where we begin to make the argument. So we've always made the argument that it's an investment in our society.
But it's an investment on one condition, and I want to take some callers on this one. Yeah. John, I'm going to come to you in a second, right? I mean, my producer tells me that we spend something like 4% of our GDP on social development, and that compares quite favorably to many international countries. Okay, fine. 4 percentage points is not too bad, particularly if you have a base international comparison. Mm-hmm. But frankly, whether we spend 1% or 10%, the question is, are we getting appropriate returns for that public monies? And I'm not even sure, without being too theoretical about it, what the success criteria would be for deciding appropriate returns on the spend. But I would have imagined that one very practical way to measure whether we get the right returns is to ask ourselves, how many people who've been getting some form of grant from the state have now become economically self-sufficient? Or what do you think should be the success criteria for deciding? Because obviously if you're really, really poor, simply making sure that someone has food on the table, that is, in one sense, success in heavy scare quotes. But over the long term, presumably, we'd like to be able to tell a good news story of many people who have become economically active after temporarily getting some form of grant from the state.
Let's look at two levels. On the one hand, you need to look at the immediacy. You've got to provide for the immediacy. People do not have bread on the table. People do not have access to nutritional food, and the grants that we provide provides them with the basis to get the minimum around those kind of issues. And there the evidence has shown that up until the global economic crisis hit us, that stunting rates were declining, experience of hunger, and I use the word experience of hunger as opposed to experience of nutritional food. You know, poor people make rational choices and they buy food, but it's not always nutritional food. But the experience of hunger has declined. A second issue that was a slightly longitudinal study looked at people who access, children who access the grant from an early stage, presumably from year one or two. And we have an issue there though. The output of the grant is that their performance in school has been better. And we now have people who've graduated from high schools into the university systems. And the accessing of the grants played a major role in their abilities to do that, from getting access to food and dignity in terms of just...
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's take a couple of calls. Lots of people want to engage in this one. Johan, good morning to you. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, UCBS, and good morning to your guest. I'm in the process of reading Yan Joubert's book on 2019. And
good call. Very good book, Kat.
He specifically refers to the social grants. And just to start off with, I'm a total supporter of social grants. And he was talking about just under 17.5 million people actually receiving social grants. Mm-hmm. He then puts into the background the fact that 15 million people are employed and the tax base is 5 million. So there's this situation where we grant tax-free status for 10 million people who are employed, and I grant you they may not be earning a lot of money, but if we start talking about Scandinavian countries like Sweden, et cetera, and their level of social grants that they provide, we also have to factor in the fact that from Krona 1 or Rand 1, everybody pays income tax. Now, my proposal would be that the 10 million people who are currently paying nothing, that maybe 100 rand per person would be paid in income tax, but that would be specifically ring-fenced to go towards increasing the current social grants.
But of course, it's a complicated question, Johan. Johan, the question is complicated. Right? Sorry to interrupt you there. We've got lots of callers, but I want to engage you. I think it's a beautiful conversation you're starting because our taxation, we recognize, must be progressive. In other words, although we are not socialists, nevertheless, we recognize that Eusebius, as a presenter with a decent income, will bear a disproportionate part of the burden of the tax base of the government than, for example, someone who is selling Fet Cook outside the 702 studio. So that's the first point. And then the second point is that it is not true that no one pays taxes in South Africa. The poorest of the poor have a bigger slice of their money going to the taxes. Once you take into account, for example, the food inflation of people who live on... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So da is the antwoord on your vraag.
Yeah, no. I agree with what a lot of what you're saying. My fear is that the problem we're facing is so vast that whether we like it or not, we're going to have to call on other resources.
Okay. I hear you.
I'm just concerned that the resource base we've got, and I'm totally in favour of progressive tax system.
I can
just not able to make a dent in the problem.
Stunning question, Johan. You want to weigh in there, Zane?
Yes. I think just to reiterate your point that, you know, there's this refrain that we've got a small tax base and only a few of us pay tax. I think we must make the point that all of us pay tax. And as you've said, that the poor pay a large percentage of their income in tax compared to what you and I pay. And if we look at the contribution of VAT to the fiscus, it's about a third. right? Corporate tax, well, in monetary terms may be the bigger, but in terms of a percentage, it's sitting at about 28%.
Yeah.
So corporate tax has actually been declining over the last 15 years. You know, personal income tax has steadily has been at the same level for a number of years. It's slightly ticking up, but VAT has just ticked up. But we all pay tax. I think the one thing is you mentioned the fact that 25% of our population, we spend about 162 billion per annum on them. But 5% of the population, we spend about 80 billion, 60 to 80 billion on tax rebates. And that's the social grant to the rich. And when we look at, when we talk about the discretionary income and the arguments we need to make within government about how to use our tax system better and make it more progressive, you can actually begin to question or review the kind of rebates that the rich get, whether it's, you know, in lieu of medical aid support or a number of other sources.
So would this be right that if I understand what you're saying now, living under conditions of poverty is actually relatively more expensive than living in the high LSM brackets?
Absolutely. Let's take the issue of dignity of work. There's a limit at which work becomes undignified.
Mm.
If the bulk of your income is spent on getting to work, on just meeting basic needs, not even, you know, the cappuccino that you and I would drink and take for granted. The basics, just the basics to survive.
Mm.
And then you find that you've got to borrow from some Oshanisa to make it in the end. There's a level at which work becomes undignified.
100%.
The issue of dignity of work cannot be linked. And social protection needs to be looked at also in view of the minimum wage issue. So the document that was tabled in November 2016 at NEDLAC, talking about comprehensive social security, you know, looked at social protection, looked at the minimum wage issues, and said you can't delink all of these issues. That if you're going to talk about, you know, the NDP's goal of getting a significant level of your income distributed to the poor and the lower quantiles, then you've got to look at social protection plus minimum wage.
Mm.
And the dependency issue is definitely linked to wage. That there's an, you know, in poor households, generally people are dependent on one or two wages. And if those wages are depressed, then the poverty levels increase.
23 minutes after 10, we're talking about the welfare state. I hope you're learning a lot as I am this morning from the former DG of Social Development, Zain Dango, who is now at the Soul City Institute. And it's fascinating. And I know that as the middle class, we have good reason to moan because many of us have to opt out of state services like education, health, and even safety for that matter, and spend a lot of money, for example, in private security that you and I spoke about last Thursday. So we have an incredible burden. But if you think we have a burden, I hope that you feel adequately informed about the even worse burden of living under conditions of poverty.
You're CBS Makaiza on 702 and Cape Talk.
Yeah, you're not going to get a more important debate this week on radio than this one. We are talking about the welfare state because honestly, the millions of South Africans who live under conditions of poverty, if we do not get them out of poverty, then we can kiss goodbye all of these beautiful developmental goals we had set for ourselves and the normative vision of the Constitution. That's exactly why we have Zain Dango with us today. He's got enormous experience as someone who's been at the heart of the state trying to design an optimal system when it comes to welfare and social development. We'll take a couple of questions then, and then maybe after the 10:30 news break, you can tackle a few of them. But let's give the public a chance to come in on this one. John, thank you for holding on. What did you want to say or ask?
Eusebius, thank you for having me. My name is John Barrington, and I head up a political party that is proposing a basic income grant of 5,000 rand per month for every adult South African citizen. A 2.165% levy on all the money that goes through the banking system will pay for a basic income grant, it will pay for the fiscus and a number of other things to boot.
Okay, I'm going to ask him what he thinks about that, both in terms of its desirability and feasibility. A question there on Twitter asked Zain why he left DSS. He left because he was doing his job. Victor, good morning. What is your question?
Good morning, Eusebius. Good morning, Zain. I would like to know, elderly people, when they retire at 60, they qualify for 1,900. But when they go and apply, they tell them that they can't get that money because their wives are still working and they can only give them half as a cost-saving measure. Now, this elderly person at 60 cannot be employed anywhere else. They all come to us and ask us, what do they do now? Because they can't be employed. They're getting half of their their grants. And why is it like that?
Okay, good question.
Why is it like that?
Okay, good question. I don't understand that mechanism. I'm sure Zane will. Willie, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Eusebius.
Good morning, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, I worked for a company, man, and I contributed to a pension fund. You know, in 1916, those years, what did we work for? Peanuts. When I applied now for a pension, because I told them the truth that I'm getting a small pension from my company, they said, no, you do not, you cannot get a full pension from SASA. 2 years ago, it was mentioned that they'll do away with the means test, but it's still there. I don't know when they're going to do away with that means test.
Okay, let's leave it there, Willie.
Okay, please.
Okay, cool. We'll answer your question. I think some people think you are still in the statement, Zane, wearing your multiple hats here, but he's got enough institutional memory to tackle some of your questions. Koketsa, I will come to you. You know you're one of my faves. You also are not the most pithy of my faves, so I'm going to have to take you on the other side of the news headline.
Eusebius Makhayza on your number one news and talk station.
5,000 Rand basic income grant for all adults, yay or nay?
Yay. I'm not sure about the quantum, but I think in terms of the principle of the basic income grant, I've been a supporter of it for many years. I was part of the basic income grant platform with COSATU and others in the early 90s and late 80s. The minister that actually employed me into government, Zola Skweyiya, was a major proponent of the basic income grant. And essentially the argument was that if you get more incomes into households and everybody accesses a income, the arguments that we've seen in terms of evidence for the child support grant and the state old age pension in terms of people being able to contribute to the economy, seeking to replicate that income, holds water. And
what would be the mechanism? How far did you get in the thinking?
Well,
would it be every adult that's unemployed, every adult, is it means tested, everyone in the same house?
No, those modalities were the issues that we could not agree on. And also there was an ideological barrier at that point. And we just could not get this argument across to decision makers who saw it as we cannot afford it. The modalities that we thought at that point was to use the tax system, you know. So for those who are employed, you get the basic income grant, but if you earn enough, we claw it back through the tax. You claw it back through taxation. Mm. And for those who are not in the tax system because unemployed, SASA plays a role in making sure that people access the basic income grant. Ironically, the very people that used to be critical of the basic income grant are now seeing it as a solution to high unemployment levels across the globe. The crisis in capitalism, you've got high unemployment rates in places like Spain, Greece, and growing unemployment in much of Europe. And the fourth industrial revolution, where technology is replacing human beings. And youth unemployment is a problem not only in South Africa now, it's a global problem. And some of the same ideologues, such as the IMF and the World Bank, are now pushing the basic income grant as a solution. So suddenly some of us are beginning to question, we should not use the basic income grant as a means to plug an inequality gap that could also be dealt with through other ways. But in terms of the principle of the basic income grant, I think we need to pursue it. We need to look at how do we make it work in our society. I think it is a solution, and especially, you know, people throw the term in fourth industrial revolution out, and the fact that jobs, the nature.
If we already have around 17.5 million people, isn't that? I mean, I get you that the amount that you spend is more important than the number of people getting assisted by the state, and I think that insight alone is probably one of the most important for this hour, because the public often fixate on the wrong measurement, but nevertheless, I'd love to see the numbers being run for what a basic income grant would then do to the overall digits.
Yeah. See, I think what we need to look at is not just the digits, but what does it displace? Does it displace this child support grant? Does it replace the state old age pension? And those were the contestations between proponents of the child support grant and those proposing the basic income grant. And we're going to have to look at, does it, if you're saying 1,000 per household, 1,000 per person,
exactly.
Does it take away the state old age pension or is it add on? And this is where we need to look at what other mechanisms are in place. So let's look at the state old age pension. So we've got two callers, for example, that spoke about the fact that we have a means test in place. One of the steps towards getting a basic income grant is remove the means test for both the child support grant and the state old age pension. Because what it does is we have an area of exclusion issue, that there's people who are just marginally above the means test, and based on the calculation, they are then excluded. And you almost get this notion of the deserving and undeserving poor. That you have to be so poor to get this income that perhaps it doesn't make much of a difference beyond survival. But if you actually make sure that people get it who have some other form of income, you add on, so it's grants plus. And this then also it takes away,
because they're all poor.
Yeah. And you also take away this the incentive for people to begin to hide away other forms of income, and also make sure that people pursue other forms of income, because there's no fear of losing your state old age pension. The systemic issue here is the fact is that people retire into poverty. And this is where the comprehensive social security proposals come in. We have proposed, aside from taking away the means test, a single fund that all of us contribute to when we work. Those of us with means will then be able to still top it up in the private sector. And then you will be able to have people, unlike, my mom worked as a garment worker and she worked at Clicks, but she retired into poverty and had to go back on the state old age pension as the only means of income. If we have a different system and we reform the tax system, and this document has been sitting at NEDLAC and I don't know where it's gone to. So the proposal is on the table. The proposal to take away the means test has been agreed to by the governing party, both the child support grant. What is missing is the capability of the state to implement these measures.
Yeah, because that's what I was asking you during our first spot break, Zane. Maybe we can just have a quick and then we'll take okay to on-air summary of what you had told me. The question I put to Zane was whether, because he's part of another, basically sits on another group that is trying to think about policy. And again, it's a very South African thing, isn't it? We can never decide whether, in essence, our state has a capacity problem or whether, in essence, we still have fundamental policy rethinks across various parts of the social and economic clusters that needs to happen. The easiest answer is to say a little bit of both, but if we are being hard-ass about it, which fundamentally is it?
Look, what we have, if you look, we started off with a discussion on the Constitution. Our Constitution essentially has positioned South Africa as a social democratic state. It essentially has done that. The kind of policies that have been explicated out of that essentially position South Africa as a social democratic state. Key policy issues that are missing is a minimum wage policy, incomes-based policy in relation to that. What we need is a consequential state, a state that says, this is our decision, we're going to implement it. The private sector will accept that. Engagement with the private sector is uncertainty. We're not sure whether you're going to raise taxes so they can have redistribution, because we're hearing two different things. We need to develop the capability of the state to implement the idea of the nature of the state that we're agreeing on. There's contestation about that in the political space. But I think we're lucky in the South African context. I say lucky in that there's a narrow space for political parties to contest within, is that you cannot get the kind of alt-right economic policies in our scenario. You'll be litigated against. You cannot say, let's do away with social protection. You'll need 75% of the of votes in parliament to do that. So the space in which political parties can navigate is narrow. What we need to be doing is looking at what is the capability of the state over a 20-year period to implement these. And this is where the issue of state capture robbed us of the capabilities to do what we needed to do over the last
decade or so. 18 minutes before 11, if you want to be part of this conversation, we're talking about the welfare state. What are your ideas for how we can best deal with some of the systemic challenges, policy channel challenges, but also technocracy ones within the state? 011-883-0702, give us a call. You can engage Zane Dangle, who, of course, is former DG of Social Development, who's now also with the Seoul City Institute. Years of experience being part of the system trying to make this work. And if you're in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567, 18 minutes before 11.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Anecdote is a powerful thing, which is why so many people say, no, Zane, I don't care what you are saying. I know of Trumpy and Trumpy's daughter who fell pregnant so they can get the child support grant. What is fact and what is fiction? Why do we not seem to have in the public debate about child support grants agreed, robust data about whether or not there's a perverse incentive for our young people to fall pregnant?
In the first sort of 5 years of this, when we extended the child support grant from 1.2 million people and extended it to children up to the age of 6 and then 14 and then 18, the issue of perverse incentives emerged as an argument against that. The studies, so we commissioned studies to UNICEF in the Human Sciences Research Council, and the empirical evidence showed that this was not the case. One only has to look at the fact that we have a major gap between children between the ages from birth to three that are not on the system.
Mm.
So it's nonsensical in many ways to argue that you're getting pregnant to access the child support grant, but they're not coming forward and actually applying for people to get the grant between those most critical ages. We regard the first sort of 1,000 days from a developmental perspective as the most important period from which to invest in children, make sure they get access to nutritional food. And we actually go out and tell people, please register your child as soon as they are born.
And they often don't.
They don't. We have a major problem for children between the age of 0 and 3. To the point where we had to get SASSA to go out and go on a campaign to make sure that people register their children as soon as they are born. So it doesn't make sense to argue that people are falling pregnant. Secondly, our total fertility rate is declining. Our total fertility rate in South Africa is declining, which includes the total fertility rate for what is called the people who fall, what are categorized as young mothers or teenage pregnancies. The problem is that...
So why do these myths keep proliferating, do you think?
We don't hide away teenage pregnancies anymore. You're not allowed to be kicked out of school. That's the first. We also have a youth bulge. We have the youngest ever population in South Africa's history. So even though the total fertility rate has declined, you will see visibly you'll see people pregnant.
Okay.
But it's statistically relevant, the number of the fact that people are having less children. Mm-hmm. We are becoming a society that's aging over the next 20 years.
Wow.
If one looks at population trends, we're going to have a challenge of an aging society. Because of the investment in antiretrovirals, the life expectancy is going up. We also have a lower fertility rate across all quintiles. It's not just the rich. So I think when people interrogate the evidence, yes, and you look at anecdotes, but anecdotes are powerful because that's the thing that causes...
They can be lodged in your brain. Yeah. Coquetso, you've been extremely patient. Thank you so much for holding on.
Yeah, morning, Yubi.
Good morning.
Yeah, morning. And morning to your guests, too. Yubi, I just wanted to add to the basic income grant discussion that you were having.
Yes.
There's actually been a pilot project done. I think it was in Iceland. About this basic income grant where they took a group of people and, what they actually saw is that actually contrary to this thing, making people not active, economically active, what it actually did is that even allowed people who couldn't actually find employment to start their own businesses where they were either selling clothing or selling something. So this basic income grant on a small scale has actually been proven that it actually can sort of get people who are not economically active to be economically active, either through owning small businesses or actually finding employment. So in other words, like improving their education in order to upskill themselves to get the jobs, And then the points I actually wanted to make, Yubi, was regarding like the social development, the whole welfare state model. My issue, I think, and I think why a lot of people sort of have issue with it is the fact that it's almost like something that we don't see our way out of it. So what I mean by that is that it doesn't allow for people to either educate themselves or upskill themselves so that they can actually escape poverty, you know, so that they can almost, you know, allow for social mobility within that. So for, in other words, that if you're born in a very poor family, what within the social welfare state allows for your social mobility where, you know, that people can either pay for their kids to go to a very good school so that the kid can, you know, either go to a very good high school, then from there go get university education. And as a result, actually allow the family to escape poverty by you know, assisting the family by getting better access to
absolutely
employment, yeah, and a job. So I think if within that amount that's given for food and things like that, if there was actually amount ring fenced for the child's education or something, where people can actually have that option of taking their kids to university or even actually not even university, because that's at the tail end, a good primary school and a good high school, and then in other words, like, you know, resulting where the child can actually get a very sort of, you know, access to good university education or good tertiary education, and then actually allow the family to escape poverty by making sure that, you know, we now call it black tax, but it's actually, in a way, it's a good thing in the sense that people are now helping their families and actually literally lifting them out of poverty, you know. So where is it in the social development model that allows for that, for people to escape the clutches of poverty?
Okay, excellent question. Thank you, Ketsa. Really appreciate that one. Memory, good morning to you. Hello, Memory. I think Memory has forgotten that she has called in. Janet, good morning.
Good morning. Are you speaking to me?
I think so, Janet.
Janet, yes. Hello, Eusebius. I'm calling from distant Scottsboro on the Natal coast. I wanted to say that I followed Minister Zola Squeyea for many years, watching him in great admiration. He was a wonderful minister. And he was very strong on all of the things that he did correctly. And I just wanted to say that listening to and watching his funeral in Four Ways, it was quite the, or if it was Four Ways, it was the biggest outpouring of love for a human being that I have heard for a long time. And I think that that outpouring of love must have had a huge effect on South Africans. I just wanted to say it's got nothing much to do with what you're talking about, but I just wanted to say that for Zola Squeyea and his family.
Okay, thank you for that, Janet. Much appreciated. Now, Koketsa asked a very important question, which is, what in the design of the social development system, Zane, is explicitly aimed at making sure we get people economically or otherwise active rather than simply being recipients of grants?
And, you know, when we talk about a capability of the state, we need to look at the state as a whole, right? So my first thing, you know, first things first, Social Security, the Department of Social Development, must ensure that through its agencies, it pays its grants to the people who deserve it. That's our first job.
Mm.
Do it well so that those who need it get it.
Absolutely.
Make sure that the policy regime around the you know, the to eliminate administrative or policy barriers are taken away.
Mm.
We have included in the model those who access grants, and we've spoken about the good impacts it has in school, then are able to access NSFAS, and they don't have to do the applications and don't have to go through the means tests at universities. But the big issue is, she spoke about good primary schooling, good high school and tertiary education. That must be, in terms of the argument of a capable state, must be what the departments of education do. You must have a good primary school. You must have a good secondary schooling. And from a policy perspective, you must make sure that it's free and qualitative. And that's when you begin to break the cycle of poverty. We shouldn't be burdening the Department of Social Development to talk about how do you ramp off people. We should be looking at what's being done in the economic clusters to ensure that the economy is structured in such a way that people get jobs. I must make the point again that people who access grants are those who are inactive in the labor market. It's children. Of course, that their caregivers get the money on behalf of the children, but the money is for the children. They are inactive. It goes to people who are disabled, so they are inactive due to disability. They are inactive due to age.
Mm.
We do not have the kind of social protection system that provides for everybody. That is where the issue of a basic income grant or other means of making sure that those who are able-bodied, unable to find jobs between the ages of 18 and 55 or 60, access some means of support if we make the assumption that unemployment is not voluntary but involuntary. Involuntary in the sense that we do not have the economy or structure the economy in such a way that we can absorb labor and pay people at a decent wage.
But in between those two positions, position A, where your social development objective is to make sure that people who right now need something in their lunchbox gets it, and the other extreme where you want social development to effectively also be doing the work that should be done in other ministries, from education to the rest of the economic cluster. In between, some people will often refer to and play example table tennis, of course, because they want to hide their own ideological convictions, to things like conditional grants in certain parts of the world, like in South America. And they will say to you, okay, Zane, I hear you. I'm not expecting you to necessarily get your CBS aunt into a job tomorrow. However, surely we are in a long set of steps, one step closer to getting her economically active, if we attach at least some conditions, make her more active in her community. For all you know, the next thing she discovers that she has a passion for early childhood development because we forced her to go to the school.
Sure. Let's look at the outcomes. You know, so by all objective assessments, South Africa's outcomes in terms of its social protection system outstrips countries like Brazil, even where you have conditional grants. Conditional grants are meant to deal with a particular mischief. So if there's a health issue and people are not going to clinics, then you can say, you've got to go and tick the box at the clinic for your child to get the grant. We're finding that people are actually going to the clinics and getting immunized. So there's no particular mischief to be remedied in that space. We need to ask, is being inactive as a parent of a child as a result of being, the issue is it voluntary or involuntary? No, there might be some people who choose not to work, but the bulk of people want to work. What the grant is already doing, and I think this is what Koketso is saying with the Finland example, with the basic income grant, it's the exact same thing with our transfers to households, is that we're finding that people are more willing to go out and look for work when there's an experience of a regular income. What the Finland example is showing is that people are, because the quantum is slightly higher in the pilot, because it's a pilot, people do not, they don't get stuck in dead-end jobs, so there's dignity. They can use the pilot shows that they can use the money to look for other work. They can use it to collectivize it with a few friends and start businesses. And if we can get the quantum right within our existing space, we will actually find that not only are we dealing with absolute poverty and inequality, but we're also contributing to people meaningfully participating in the economy and going out to look for work. And I think that's the component of it. It's developmental. Lastly, I don't think we must make this distinction between a developmental state and a welfare state. Somebody just mentioned Zola Skuwiya. So, I started working with him and I loved him. And one of the issues that he always asked his colleagues, what is wrong with the welfare state? You're always talking and stigmatizing a welfare state. When we met many years ago, we met the foreign minister of Sweden, not foreign minister, the minister of finance of Sweden, and he just said, build the system. South Africa is in a better space to build a welfare state or social protection oriented state than we were when we started post-World War II in Sweden.
Okay. Memory, very quickly, your question. Okay, I'm afraid, Memory, you've had two bites of the cherry there. We're absolutely going to leave it there. So I think you've answered the other issue that I wanted to get to, which is the other stigmatization around welfare states, is that it somehow makes people more lazy. But the empirical data suggests that, in fact, it can spur you on, particularly if you are one of those unemployed people that have now given up seeking job, that having an income can, in fact, reignite in you a motivation to seek a job.
Yes. And the fact that you're taking away stigma, one of the advantages of universalization is that we all get it. You and I get it, but it's clawed back through the tax system. So it's not this is for the poor, unwashed. This is for all of us. Those who need it more will use it more. Those who don't need it will not use it, and we will take that money back through the tax system. So taking away the stigma also allows people to engage in the economy. And essentially that's at the basis of what a solidarity society is all about. We act in solidarity with each other. Remember, it's not the state that's paying the social grants. It's you and me and others, including those who pay VAT, who are acting in solidarity with those of us who cannot participate in the economy.
Absolutely.
And that's the important thing. We can't stigmatize the people that we support, and we're stigmatizing our own families.
That's true. That is so true. Zain, you've been stunning. Thank you for sharing your insights and your institutional knowledge with us. Thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here, Mr. Miz. Thank you.